TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. Now, I don't think anybody is in any doubt as to the hazards of using a handheld mobile phone while you're driving. In the UK, it's been illegal since 2003. You get 6 points on your licence if you're caught and a £200 fine. And, of course, that's all been well documented. But what about if you're using a phone that isn't in your hand, a hands-free phone, or indeed a Bluetooth phone? There's been some studies into this, and somebody who has a view on it is Professor of Psychology David Crundall of Nottingham Trent University, who joins us this morning. Good morning. Thank you for joining us, David.
Good morning, Bill.
There was a big article in one of the national newspapers about this, in which they, over-egged your thoughts on this a little, but you do have some thoughts on it, don't you?
Yes, well, I have done some research in this area. I'm a traffic and transport psychologist.
Right.
And one of the things that we know from studies that I've done, but also studies that people have done around the world, is that it's not just the holding of the handset that forms a distraction.
Mm.
It's actually more of what we call a cognitive distraction, what's going on in the brain.
Right.
If you're having to think about two things at the same time, what you're seeing out of the car window, but also the conversation that you're having with your hands-free conversational partner, then there's going to be a problem.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting you say that, because if you're, I see many people who are kind of coming towards me, wavering all over the road, and they're clearly having a conversation with the person next to them, and they're doing what humans do. They turn towards them and talk at them rather than carrying looking straight ahead.
Yes, now, talking to people in a car is different. A lot of people say, well, a hands-free phone call, surely that's no different to speaking to a passenger. And yes, speaking to a passenger can be dangerous, but usually it's more dangerous if the passenger isn't a driver themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it still is more dangerous to talk on a hands-free phone than it is to talk to a passenger, because there are certain differences there, such as the nature of the conversation you're having may be different. You might be talking to the passenger about what you're going to eat for tea that evening. Or you might be on a mobile phone talking to somebody about the quarterly sales figures. Now, one of those is going to be a little more potentially distracting than the other.
Mm.
But one of the other things that we find, and we did a study on this some years ago, is that if you have a passenger who's also a driver, they can see what you can see.
Mm.
The person on the end of a hands-free mobile phone can't see what you can see. Now, we have a problem here that when the road starts to get more demanding and more dangerous, the person sat next to you, if they understand what road danger is about, then they will be quiet. They'll shut up for a bit. If you're coming to merge onto a motorway, they'll be quiet while you make that merge, and they won't expect you to talk back to them. The person on the other end of the mobile phone, however, has none of that visual information. So they'll keep talking to you while you're trying to make that merge or while you're trying to pull out from a busy junction. And of course, we being social creatures, we like to try and respond to keep that conversation going.
Yep.
And it becomes difficult. They keep talking to us. We feel the social urge to talk back to them. So as the dangers of the road get more difficult, the conversation becomes more dangerous.
And in fact, they could be even more distracting, because if you stop talking to them because you're concentrating for a moment, they will probably say, hello, hello, can't you hear me, can't you hear me, and disrupt you even more.
Yes, and that's exactly what we found in our study from some years ago, that even when the driver tried to be silent so that they could concentrate on the road demands, the number of questions that the person on the other end of the phone was asking started to increase. And you can see this all the time when people are driving, that you will have people on the other end of the mobile phone saying, oh, are you still there? Are you still there? Are you okay? And that's going to be even much more of a distraction. So if you do have to have a mobile phone conversation, and I don't recommend it at all when driving, but if it's unavoidable, what you should definitely do is preface the conversation with, I'm driving.
Yeah.
If I go quiet suddenly, it's just because I'm having to concentrate on the road. Then at least you've got over to the person on the other end of the phone the potential difficulties that you might be facing.
Yes, I suppose there are two issues before, weren't there, with the phone where you're physically holding it. You've got a problem because you're supposed to be driving a car with both hands on the wheel for a start. And if you're driving a manual vehicle or you need to indicate, you can't do that actually without letting go of the wheel completely.
Yes. Now, a lot of people, when they're making a phone call, typically in the UK these days it is just hands-free phones, they will make a decision on whether it's safe to do so on the basis of how far they can see down the road, their knowledge of the road, their knowledge of the time of day. So if you're driving along a motorway and there is no other traffic on the roads and it's a beautifully clear day, visibility is great, you might think, that's fine, I'm going to make a phone call. Mm. Now, people still do that in terms of the hands-free, in terms of handheld unit when they shouldn't be, but they're making a decision to maybe type something and then put the phone back on the dashboard because they think they can see far enough in advance. Mm. Now, some people may be able to do that, but more people think that they can do that when actually it's a lot more dangerous than they think, because the road demands can change. It's not just about seeing how far down the road there is any traffic, because traffic can come from anywhere. It can come from side roads, it can come from behind, there could be debris in the road that you've not noticed. So the demands faced by the driver on the road change on a second-to-second basis, and it's very difficult for any individual to predict how long they have got to engage in a manual task or even just a hands-free phone call. But people do this all the time. No one goes to try and change the radio when they're driving around the bend. And that's exactly what people are doing when they're making a mobile phone call. Yeah. They're choosing, in essence, when to engage with it on the basis of their prediction about how safe the road is going to be. But oftentimes, our predictions are flawed. And research suggests that those people who think that mobile phones, who think that it's the easiest task to engage in a mobile phone conversation, actually, they're the ones who underestimate the demands of driving the most.
Interesting. I did some pilot training, and as part of that training, you're taught to kind of increase your awareness of peripheral vision. In other words, what's happening outside of your directly in front of you, for obvious reasons. When you're in the sky, you need to look out for other aircraft. And actually, a lot of driving is about peripheral vision, isn't it?
Yes, it is. There's a lot of information that comes to the driver in terms of the speed that they're going. So the speed of things like trees and bollards going past you in peripheral vision give you this feel of what we call optic flow. But there's a lovely, interesting finding that when you put an eye tracker on a driver, mm-hmm. and you send them out, so we actually have glasses that you put on them, and at the end, once they've done a drive, you look at this video from a camera in the glasses, and a little dot on the video shows exactly where they were looking while they were driving. When you do that, if you do it with experienced drivers, you tend to find that they look quite far down the road, and of course to the left and the right.
Yeah.
Whereas novices don't look as widely. So they suffer from this sort of almost perceptual narrowing. But also they tend to look at the lane markers very close to the car.
Yeah.
And this is because the expert drivers who have had years of experience have grown their peripheral vision, or what we call the functional field of view. The extent to which they can sample information from peripheral vision is larger for them. And so that they can sample these lane markers through peripheral vision.
Oh.
So if you're an expert driver and you're driving along a road, you don't tend to look at the lane markers unless you're going around a bend, because the information is coming in through peripheral vision. With your novice drivers, your young drivers, however, because everything is so new to them, they can't use their peripheral vision as well. So therefore, they have to actually look at the lines that they're driving past in order to make sure they're staying in lane, which is an extra danger for those novice drivers.
How very interesting. Now, you've done a lot of research on trying to reduce collisions across Europe, and that's a potential of something you're calling a hazard perception test. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, the hazard perception test developed or was originated in the UK, and research started on this in the early 70s with the idea that if we could have a test that could show whether some people are more likely to have a crash than others, then we can keep the worst offenders off the road.
Wow.
Now, the research continued for 20 years or so until the UK government thought that there was enough evidence to bring this in as part of the driving test. So in 2002, the hazard perception test came into the UK. Now, what happens is everyone who wants to pass their test, first of all, has to go to a government office to do a theory test.
Yeah.
But when they're doing their theory test, they also do the hazard perception test. They sit in front of 14 video clips which show the scene as if you are driving along a road. It used to be video. Now the governments have invested in computer-generated imagery.
Right.
But it all shows you the same sort of driving along the road, then something happens. Maybe a car pulls out of a side road, a pedestrian steps into the road, and you have to press a button. The quicker you press the button, the more points you get, and you have to get over a certain number of points to pass the test.
Mm.
Now, the assumption there, or the theory underlying it, is that people who score more points are better able to spot those hazards on the road, and therefore should be safer. The quicker you spot a hazard, the faster you are to be able to respond in the real world. And when the government brought this in, 6 years later, they published data back in 2008,
mm-hmm.
To show that the introduction of the hazard perception test in the UK had significantly reduced a certain type of collisions that young drivers were having.
Oh.
So it's been a big success story in the UK. But what we've not seen is a huge take-up of this test in governments around the world. And this is something that is quite dear to my heart, this idea that if we live in a country that has actually got quite good road safety rates, so the UK is typically in the top 3 or 5 countries in the world for road safety rates.
Right.
Not saying that we don't have our problems, we do, but we're quite good. And what we should be doing is looking to export our safety initiatives to those countries that could benefit even more from them. Now, we know that Australia, they're very big into their hazard perception testing,
mm-hmm.
And the Netherlands have developed their own hazard perception test, and there are certain other countries in Europe that are looking at this, but as yet we've not seen the widespread uptake. Now, there is a potential reason for this. It's that actually the hazard perception test that we have in the UK might not work so well in other countries.
Mm.
And we've seen this. We took the hazard perception test to Malaysia. We've taken it to China. We've done it in Spain.
Have you?
Interesting. We're creating more tests at the moment. I mean, we work with some brilliant researchers at the University of Granada, and they're developing Spanish hazard perception tests. The problem is that when you see that hazard, the assumption is you press as soon as you see the hazard.
Yeah.
And that represents how safe you are. But that's not the full story, because the safer the driver you are, the more hazards you are likely to have seen during your time while driving.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, when you see that car coming towards the junction, which might pull out,
yep.
then you look at it and you think, well, I'm a skilled driver. I can handle this at this point. It's not that hazardous. Then it gets a bit closer. Now you think, well, now maybe I should definitely press because I think I would have trouble with it.
Right.
And you press. Your novice driver, however, might not see the hazard at all. They might be looking all over the place, and then all of a sudden they see it just as the car's going to pull out, and they press the button. What you end up with then, potentially, is that both drivers have pressed at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really unfair to say that the experienced driver is not safer than the novice driver because they've spotted the vehicle sooner. And we can see this again with eye tracking research. And it's what we call the threshold problem. If you have a higher threshold for reporting a hazard, then you're likely to press later. But also the problem goes in the opposite direction as well. Because you're an expert safe driver, it means that you might spot the clues so early that you press too soon. So the hazard perception test is based on the idea that there is a scoring window. If you press once that window is opened, you score maximum points. But if you press just before the window opens, so let's say you see a pedestrian walking down the street, they turn their head to look at you, and you press. But unfortunately, the scoring window might only start when the pedestrian actually turns their body and puts their foot towards the road.
Mm.
So you've seen it too soon, pressed too soon, and therefore got 0 points. So what we've been trying to do is develop a new form of hazard perception test. Because, of course, this problem of desensitization to hazards is really big when you go to places like China and Malaysia.
Yeah.
You put a Malaysian driver in front of a UK hazard perception test, they never press. You put an English driver in front of a Malaysian hazard perception test, they're pressing all the time. Everything is a hazard for them.
And you put a Spaniard in front of one, he'll press it tomorrow.
So there's all these sorts of threshold problems which are so pertinent when you start talking about exporting these tests to another country. So we've done a really simple thing. We've just taken these hazard perception clips and we stop them at the point where the hazard just starts, and we turn the screen to black and we just say, what happens next? We give people four options and they have to choose one of the four options. So we have no problems of response times, no problems with these scoring windows, no problems about whether you think that would be a hazard for your skill level or not, because we're not asking that. We're just asking what happens next. And we found that that test discriminated between novice and experienced drivers in Spain, in Malaysia, in China, as well as in the UK, whereas the typical hazard perception test really has problems when we take it out to these other countries because of these cultural differences.
How very interesting. And could you then say, extrapolate that theory then, that once you'd got that hazard perception test right and it was working cross-border, which is the ideal thing, would you recommend then that people who never have taken a hazard perception test in their life, despite the fact they're holding a driving license, should be taking it to see actually what their perception of hazards now is?
Certainly. I mean, one of the problems is that across Europe, in most countries, you will pass your driving test and then you won't consider retraining or enhancing your skills at any point. I mean, some countries will have, once you get to a certain age, you may have to do something to say that you are still legal to drive. But for potentially 50 years of your life, you will never seek to test your skills or retrain or anything like that. I'm a big proponent of lifelong driving, lifelong learning. Yeah. We should always be developing our skills. And while these hazard perception tests are extremely important for the young drivers, because of course they don't see hazards, but if they watch all of them on the videos, it's like creating artificial memories for them so that when they see these hazards on the road, they know how to respond. But equally, it's important for experienced drivers who have never done these tests before and professional drivers. We're developing tests for LGV or HGV drivers at the moment. We've also developed one for fire appliance drivers. So professional drivers again suffer this threshold problem with hazard perception tests. But our new test, the hazard prediction test, we're calling it, has again shown that we can discriminate between safe fire appliance drivers and less safe fire appliance drivers just with this simple test. And that's great. Once you know who's good, who's not so good, you can better direct your training. We all know that resources for training are being cut to the bone in so many professions at the moment due to austerity and cuts. And if you can target your training better, you're going to make better use of your resources and hopefully reduce collisions on the road.
What an interesting discussion. Thank you so much, David, for coming on and talking about both those things. In fact, we covered quite a few topics there. Really appreciate your time. David Crundall of Nottingham Trent University, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill.
Take care.